Where are we going right now in the conflict in Ukraine? On one side, we are hearing that the United States is sending F-16s to Ukraine and they're capable of carrying nuclear bombs, which politically is important, it seems. And on the
Now,
other
that's
hand, we
political.
see
The
in
F-16s
Norway, they're sending more weapons to Norway. How do you find the current phase of the conflict?
I'm more optimistic. I mean, I've always believed since the beginning of this conflict that as long as Russia keeps the political will, that it will inevitably end in their favor, even if it's not, even if it's an ugly victory, as John Mearsheimer once said. I've only become more convinced with that with time. There was a report, a article that the Kiev regime's top military general Sirski did in The Guardian in the last week, and it was it titled the editors titled it something ridiculously like, "I know we will win this war and I know how we'll do it," and then he presented absolutely nothing. He presented actually the opposite. And he gave us a lot of numbers that us, shall we say, in the alternative media community, a lot of your guests have all talked about for the last 2 years as the reality of the situation, and that the Western mainstream media has just been feeding constant propaganda and disinfo, Russia running out of this, Russia running out of this, Russian troops fighting with shovels, blah blah blah, you know, for the 2 years. And it was a cold splash in the face of the Western media. They've been doing their best to ignore it, but in the course of the last 2 years, the number of Russian tanks has doubled to some 3,500. The number of Russian artillery pieces has tripled. The number of Russian armored vehicles, infantry fighting vehicles, APCs, I believe, has also tripled. Certainly, Russia's missile capability is just expanding. It's not decreasing. The Russian military went into this conflict with 100,000 troops. It really was a special military operation, not a full-scale invasion. It was intended to push a political settlement. It didn't work that way, largely because of the Kiev regime being supplied with the West by NATO with everything it needed. Now Sirski says the Russia will have 700,000 troops in Ukraine by the end of the year. From 100,000 to 700,000, right? At the same time, he's talking about their manpower problems, about the desperate state of their forced conscription and their press gangs, how they have a problem with manpower, how they have a problem with trained personnel, they have a problem with officer corps. And in a separate report that came out from the Kiev regime's drone chief, their drone czar, came out the same week. For those diehard Kiev regime propaganda supporters, you know, the NAFO types that have been hoping for some miraculous drone AI victory for the Kiev regime, some cold water was poured on that as well, because the Kiev regime's drone czar said that Russia has a 6-to-1 quantitative drone advantage. And on a qualitative level, however much you may question that, he said that they're on par, right? So 6-to-1 quantitative advantage and on par in the qualitative. And then, you know, we all know the big deficit in artillery shells, right? You know, and air defense and air superiority and everything piled on top of this. So we hear this not from Russian propaganda. We hear this from the Kiev regime's own top generals in the last week. It shows how dire the situation it is. And the F-16s are a joke. They're a joke. And even Sirski admitted, as has the US's top generals, by the way, that the F-16s are not going to change the battlefield, that they are not a game changer. They were good in the 1980s. I mean, Top Gun, Maverick, Iceman, you know, they were really cool back then, you know, when we were kids. But this is 2023. They're an antiquated aircraft, even if they've been refurbished. The reason that the Kiev regime is getting F-16s, and they're getting them from Netherlands and Denmark and Belgium and possibly Norway. Anyway, they were about to be mothballed, right? They were about to be put out to pasture. And the reason they're being transferred to Ukraine is because these countries got a sweetheart deal on purchasing the F-35s, which is a whole nother can of worms that they're buying into there. The F-16 is an old aircraft. It would be going up, theoretically, against the best air defense network in the world, hands down, as has unquestionably been proven, against Russia's own Air Force, which Western media tells us 700 aircraft just in the region around Ukraine, that Russia's much more modern aircraft have much longer range radar, much longer range air-to-air missiles, much more accurate, you know, on every conceivable way. And they've admitted this. The F-16s are not going to contest Russian air superiority. They're not going to be sent anywhere near the front lines, right? They're not going to be sent to the contact line. They're not going to stop Russia from dropping FAB bombs on Kiev regime fortifications. They're going to be used, according to Ukrainian general, in West Ukraine, in hiding, as close to the border as they can get, facilitating air defense, right? Trying to shoot down Russian missiles as part of an ad hoc attempt to provide Kiev regime with air defense that just isn't working. And, you know, F-16s hoping to shoot hypersonic Kinjals and Zircons out of the air. Good luck with that. That's all I can say. The other thing they could possibly eventually be used for as a replacement for the completely exterminated Kiev regime Su-24s that were used to fire the British French Storm Shadow Scalp cruise missiles, which are an air-launched cruise missile. You heard a lot about them before. You don't hear anything about them now. Why? One, Russia air defense and electronic warfare adapted to them, and they really were only getting through when they attacked an area where there wasn't air defense and electronic warfare. And two, all their carriers, their aircraft used to launch them were exterminated. So eventually we may see the F-16s assume that role once they have enough of them, if that ever happens, to undergo that role. But they'll be putting them at risk even getting close enough to the contact line to launch those. And all the while, Russia is going to be hunting them like mad, simply to make a point and to prevent the precedent. There is a very large bounty being put on the F-16s for the Russian military forces, a lot of it being sponsored by Russian corporations, right? Very big payout. Russian troops are not fearing the arrival of the F-16. They are salivating. They've been waiting for it. They want their bonuses, right? They want to bag them in F-16, just like they got bonuses for bagging Abrams and Leopards and all the other Western wonder weapons that have been sent and exterminated in Ukraine. This is going to be even more. And they're already telling us this. They're already playing down expectations, right? They're already saying what they're going to be used for. Again, it's not me saying that this is what the F-16s are going to be used for. This is Sirsky, right? This is the Ukrainians themselves. And they're going to have huge problems with maintenance, the huge amount of maintenance hours. They've trained six pilots. Well, who has trained the maintenance personnel for maintaining the notoriously maintenance-heavy requirements of the F-16? Russia has been peppering airfields in all over Western Ukraine with cluster munitions over the past month, just repeatedly. They've been exterminating whatever air defense the U.S. says to try to the West sends to try to provide cover for them. They're going to end up basing them out of Romania and occasionally flying them into Ukraine. And if they're used for combat missions in that regard, then that's a whole nother can of worms. And Russia will have to consider whether they back up their declared red line and conduct missile strikes against Western military bases and Romania and possibly Poland, that the if the F-16s fly combat missions, if they fire air defense missions, I think that Russia will probably quietly let it slide. But if they fly combat missions, literally out of Poland and Romania, then Russia will have to think again. But anyway, it's not a game changer. It's not going to change anything. It is mostly a political gesture. It is, you know, at some level, it is a degree of escalation, a further, but it is a desperate sign of escalation. And even they're telling us that they know it's not going to change anything. So where do they go from here? Where do they escalate to? Because they're not going to back down. That's not going to, certainly not going to happen under the Biden administration. And I doubt, seriously doubt, still the Russian government officially doubts that Trump will be able to change anything. So again, the only thing that's left is direct NATO intervention. But in the past month since we've talked, I have not seen any substantial further movement in that generation. It seems to be stalled. And a big part of that is the political chaos that is currently happening in the West. In France, with Macron's parliamentary defeats and his, you know, the parliament being unable to form bring about a prime minister and form a stable part of the government there. With the political chaos in the United States, with the attempted assassination of Trump, which theoretically should improve Trump's chances, Biden stepping down from re-election, the hapless Kamala Harris suddenly having to be proclaimed the new Lion King, you know, it's political chaos in much of the West. And the German government, which has been the other biggest of the Kiev regime supporters, is hanging by a thread. Now, if the Christian Democratic Union takes over, they're not going to substantially change things either. But still, there's a lot of political chaos. And I believe eventually this political chaos will be overcome, right? If it comes down to Russia not being satisfied with just the Donbass, but moving further, and as I believe they must, you know, not only for Zaporozhye and Kherson, but if they start moving on cities like, seriously, like Kharkov and Kiev and Odessa, then the question of Western direct NATO intervention will eventually resuscitate itself. But it's quite clear that for the moment, that is less on the immediate horizon than it was before. It doesn't remove it in the long term of this conflict, but it does remove it for the short term. And this whole political crisis across the West is an obstacle. It is a speed bump that they really did not want. It's very inconvenient for them on top, as is this whole crisis coming out of the Middle East. So their own plans are in chaos right now. Their plans are a hope and a prayer and dark dreams of escalation that may eventually come to fruition. But right now, everything is in chaos, and no one, maybe the only one that really has a plan that is in the driver's seat right now, more, not completely, but more so than anyone else, is the Kremlin. Right. They're keep on doing what they are doing. Their war of attrition is grinding the Kiev regime's military and NATO's stockpiles apart. Right. Remorseless, you know, not fast, faster than it was. Right. Quite obviously. Take a look what's happening in the Pokrovsk direction or in Turetsk in New York. Right. You know, not huge maneuver warfare breakthroughs. Like, that's one of the big things of the Western mainstream media. Oh, so the Russians have made some small gains, and yeah, they're winning, but there's no breakthrough. They don't understand the war Russia is waging. They've never understood it from the beginning. They continually get it wrong. I don't know how much is ignorance and how much is propaganda, but, you know, that whole narrative is just nonsense. Russia is progressing with their goals. They are more in sight than they were before, and they are moving faster than they were before. And I would not be surprised if we see some major front still open up, a new front open up in the next couple of months. I would not be surprised. You know, it's not going to be something that's going to end the war in 2 months, right? But it will, again, it will escalate a potential collapse of the Kiev regime's effective military resistance, at least in East Ukraine. And the big, again, on the horizon is always down the road, some potential NATO direct intervention. But a lot of that depends, according to the, you know, even Macron said, it depends on how far Russia goes. And I believe that Russia cannot stop, because NATO has made clear, if Russia stops, then they pump as many arms in as they can. They train up as many new conscripts as they can. They bring them into NATO. They bring them into the EU. They don't withdraw any sanctions. What possible motivation does Russia have for stopping? They'd have none. And if your hopes are on some propaganda about Russian losses at the front at 1,000 troops a day, nonsense. It's all just ridiculous propaganda out of the Kiev regime. Russian troops losses, right? Of course, they're occurring, right? But they're at a fraction of that. They're a fraction of the Kiev regime's losses. And the media zona's own estimates, until they stop providing those direct raw results of the KIA that they have been able to find in Russia on the ground, showed that Russian losses are and have always been, and have actually been decreasing quite substantially over the last 8-9 months. Russian losses have been going down because the Kiev regime's resistance is failing. Russia's becoming more adept with the Fab glide bombs, with urban assaults. Everything is progressing Russia's way on the battlefield. The Kiev regime, their days of effective military resistance are fading. Doesn't mean that they won't be able to resist, but effective resistance, it's slipping through their hands. They can do it in a few select places on the map. They can stop Russian forces, you know, in the short to medium term, like in Volchansk. All right, they've put up a very tough defense in Volchansk. In Chasiv Yar, they've put up a very tough defense for several months there, but it's slipping. It's slipping. And everywhere else, it's collapsing, right? They can hold those two places, but they can't hold everything anymore. And increasingly, the amount that they can hold will become smaller, and they'll be able to hold it for less time. The only hope they have is a NATO intervention. That's the only hope they have left. And that's down the road, and that depend a lot on political decisions that we don't know what Putin is thinking, but I certainly have my opinion on the matter. And I don't think that Russia can stop until they reach the Polish border. And anything, if they do stop before that, then they'll simply be, in one term or another, freezing a conflict that will reignite later. And why freeze a conflict when you're winning, when you're rolling? And give the opportunity, the other side, a chance to reconstitute its defense? No, you don't do that now. You're getting, you know, it's like a wolf getting its prey around the neck. You don't let loose. You keep going until you punch home.
Let's go with the worst case scenario, and with your last hope, as you mentioned, NATO getting involved in Ukraine officially. We know that they're involved more than 2 years in Ukraine, but officially they're getting involved on the battleground. What they can bring to the battleground that would be important for the battleground, for the outcome of the battle?
Yeah. Okay, so the first thing is they can't provide enough artillery shells and air defense interceptor missiles for Ukraine, for the Kiev regime. How can they provide it for their own forces, right? So that tells you right up there that the ground game will just get chewed up. But the Russian military is now the most powerful and experienced and capable ground, you know, land army in the world right now. That is a result of the conflict. They've evolved. They have strengthened. They have not weakened, right? They've got over 700,000 troops just now, right? Just committed to the special military operation, much less their million plus regular army, which, you know, is above and beyond this, right? What all NATO can do is a major air campaign, right? And that has always been what NATO has counted on and believes in, is bringing the entire NATO Air Force, which means, of course, primarily the U.S. Air Force, to bear, which would be a major, they would have to reorientate military assets from all over the world to do this, right? That they would have to draw air assets out of the Pacific to do this. It's not something that could happen overnight, and they can't in any serious way contest things on the ground without an air force to cover them. And that NATO air superiority, I believe, ultimately will be severely put to the test and possibly chewed up in the face of Russian air defense and an air war over Ukraine, right? It's in Russia's backyard. Russia has all the assets. They've been testing new long-range missiles for the S-400 air defense system at a range of easily over 500 kilometers. And the European military forces, there's all kinds of revelations now going on. The British press in the past couple of weeks has put all kinds of reports and their acknowledgement. Oh my God, we've just realized our military is deteriorated so far. They really, really suck. They're not capable of anything anymore. This type of reassessment is going on all over Europe. So all you're left with is the United States, right? And they would have to pivot forces from all over the world. So it is far from a certainty that they're willing to do that. They still hope that just the threat of NATO intervention and maybe a few human tripwire forces thrown down on the ground will somehow deter Russia. I think they've got another thing coming. I think that the real danger of a NATO-Russia war is that Russia will begin to win a direct confrontation in Ukraine, right? Right. We're not talking an invasion of Lisbon or Peoria or something like that. We're saying NATO, as such as they are, trying to take on Russia after they've already exhausted so much of their own military supplies in Ukraine. I think they would start to lose. And then the big danger would be, do they resort to tactical nuclear weapons to save, I don't know, 10,000 French troops that have been encircled in a cauldron somewhere around Odessa? I mean, what do they do? Do they use tactics? I think the real danger of this, the real danger of a nuclear escalation in this conflict comes not from Russia, but from a conventional weakness on the ground of NATO. And then, I mean, who knows what happens? That then we're in a nuclear escalation scenario. And things could go really south for all of us really quick. But that is still the greatest danger. My nightmare scenarios continue to all revolve around Odessa, because the West will not want to give up Odessa to Russia, and Russia will not want to give up Odessa to NATO. Because if the conflict ends with a Kiev regime still in Ukraine at whatever capacity, you know, whatever territory, if they still hold Odessa, then it's a NATO platform, whether it's officially drawn in or not. And that would severely allow NATO to contest control of the Black Sea. And simply in geostrategic terms, that is something that Russia cannot allow. They averted NATO from taking Crimea. which would have guaranteed that. And if you listen to the war planners, the Pentagon in Washington, they're still talking about ways of conducting a Black Sea campaign against Russia further down the line, of getting Turkey to lift Montreux Convention limits about the number of non-littoral state naval craft that can be put into the Black Sea. They've got all kinds of fantastical schemes here, but do not. It's amazing how Russia has stayed kind of laser focused on punching through the Kiev regime and attriting them in Donbass. The Western focus all along has been on Crimea and the Black Sea. That has been there. That's where their geopolitical, their geostrategic thinking has always been laser focused since this conflict has gone. And there's still lots of chatter in that regard coming out of Western military and geopolitical circles. So the game isn't over, and there could still be nasty surprises down the road. But the Western plans, or you know, and it's not codified plans, it sounds more like desperation, but what plans they did have been thrown into chaos with the political events, both domestically in the West, and now perhaps even more so with this renewed crisis in the Middle East occurring in the last few days. So a lot of flux and not a lot of certainty on any side, except for the Russians, who just keep on with their grinding attritional game that the West, the media, even the militaries do not understand attrition warfare. They don't seem to fully grasp what is happening and how on the ground, the proxy war in Ukraine has already been lost. But what the actual cementing of what a win and a losing means is still in play, right? Territorially, you know, NATO expansion, all of those things are still up in the air. But on a simply battlefield level, the proxy war has been lost, and Russia has succeeded, not just over the Kiev regime's conscript military, but over all of NATO's productive military capacity, because that's what an attrition war means.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Mark, if Trump wins in the United States, what difference can he bring to the conflict in Ukraine?
Okay, so the Russian government says they don't expect any change in U.S. policy with Trump. They have no illusions. They have no expectations. And to some degree, I completely agree with that, because we have seen Trump as president before, and we know the way things played out. And if you want to hope that Trump 2.0 will somehow be different, I mean, hope all you want. But Trump and J.D. Vance will still be the leaders of the U.S. hegemon. And that has limitations and it has obligations. So I don't expect things to substantially change. What I always regard Trump is as a chaos bomb, right? Trump is a very quixotic, very mercurial person, right? And he can be manipulated and his ego flattered and fed by the person that he last talked to 15 minutes ago into doing all sorts of crazy things, which is why when Putin said that he actually prefers Biden because Biden is predictable. When you're dealing with nuclear adversaries in game theory, you want a predictable enemy. You don't want a crazy, chaotic, you know, that's all of madman theory, right? I mean, you don't want that. That's dangerous. You want a Cold War dinosaur, octogenarian, senile, that you can predict. Now, the big question, if the Trump chaos bomb goes off, where does it go? Where does the blast go, right? If it goes off in Washington, D.C., and U.S. politics eats itself alive, wonderful, right? Maybe someone will successfully assassinate Trump or something. You know, I mean, that is, you know, again, potentially bad things can also come out of chaos like that. You know, you don't know when you're dealing with a politically unstable nuclear super, you know, fading nuclear superpower. But the chaos bomb could go off on Russia too. We don't know where that chaos bomb is going off. It is extremely difficult to predict simply because of Trump. And while from his stance, political stance, J.D. Vance will still only be the vice president, we can hope that a Trump pick for Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Secretary of Defense is in line with J.D. Vance. But that's really hard because there's not that many people in the Republican Party with those views that he has to choose from. So I don't think that J.D. Vance will determine U.S. policy. And even if J.D. Vance, even let's say that that policy and Trump really does try in one form or another to wind down the conflict in Ukraine, there is no guarantee that Russia will accept any terms that he is able to bring to the table, you know, over the deep state. Russia, why would they, you know, why would they agree to anything except exactly what they declared that their intentions were at the beginning of this conflict and have only expanded since then? And by the January is a long way away and a lot more territory and, you know, potential attrition damage could occur on the battlefield between now and January. And I believe that Russia will probably want to take more ground more quickly. They will want to do more faster to put themselves into a potential better negotiation position if it comes down to this. But Russia's hope is not on negotiating with the Trump administration, and mine isn't either. And even if it's better for Russia, even if it's going to be worse for the Middle East and for China. So it's just, which way are we going to hell in a handbasket? Again, that it doesn't guarantee global peace or stability in any stretch of the imagination. It's just which flavor of hegemon crazy we get.